Well, I was a young priest ordained just 3 years. I had been sent to Catholic University for a social work degree and had been just returned to the Diocese of Fresno when actually the Filipinos with Larry Itliong began this grape strike. And within a week, Cesar Chavez and his people then joined together with the Filipinos and began what is now known as the Delano grape strike. And I met him on that occasion very quickly because being director of Catholic Charities, the bishop of the diocese said, well, this is kind of a social matter. Why don't you take care of it? Well, and so I went down to Delano in this little tiny house that they had rented, a little tiny place with 3 or 4 rooms. It was a very humble beginning of where this whole union and farm strike began.
What was your impression of Cesar when you first met him? What did you think of him?
Well, when I walked into the room, I'd never met him before. I didn't know which one was Cesar because I mean, everybody was just so humble and so self-effacing that I mean, everyone was in effect a farm worker. And so you had no perception of who was kind of in charge or the leader because this was a fledgling little group. So I was finally introduced to him, and his humility and simplicity remained to the day he died. It was, were traits and characteristics that I think add to his greatness.
When you saw this fledgling group coming together, what were your thoughts? Did you say to yourself, boy, they've got a long ways to go, or they're in trouble, or what were your feelings?
Well, when I first met them and saw their situation, I said to myself, you know, this is very necessary for the farm workers to have this kind of effort, but I really doubt they're going to ever make it because they don't have the resources that the growers have. The growers have associations, they have law firms, they have, you name it, they've got enormous amount of political power, especially in the San Joaquin Valley. And here, this poor little group really has nothing. And so I was very doubtful at first if they had the stamina to really endure.
But at what point did you begin to believe that they would succeed?
Well, I think after that first year, 1965, September through December, I think by December, I really believed that they really were in this for the long haul, that this was going to be a long-term effort, and they were going to succeed.
But what led you to believe that?
I think their faith in the movement. I think their ability to communicate with farm workers. I think their ability to tell farm workers or have farm workers pause and say to them, is this really the kind of situation you want for your family? Are these wages and working conditions and lack of benefits, is this really what you want for your family? And do you want your children to inherit this future for themselves? And they're able to resonate quickly with the farm workers, and I think got quickly very immediate response as a rallying point that, no, we want change, we want improvement.
Now, did that come, do you think, did you feel from Cesar or from all the people that were involved in the movement?
Well, I think it came from all of them. Cesar was a very charismatic leader. He had a way of speaking to the farm workers in which they knew instantly that he was a farm worker, that he had a vision, he could help shape a future and direction and bring energy to it, and he had a sense of optimism. Seldom did I ever see Cesar in a negative or down mood. Cesar was always optimistic no matter what had happened, and they had a lot of adversities.
Now, you were in a very interesting situation in that you were brought in to mediate disputes between the farm workers and the growers. How difficult was it? Was it a sticky situation?
It was awful. It was a terrible, terribly difficult situation because virtually all of the growers and all of the farm workers were Catholics. So what happened almost overnight was both sides said, well, since we're Catholics, the church must be on our side. Well, the problem was we had both sides saying the same thing. And so it was an enormous tension. I didn't experience it quite as bad at first personally because I wasn't in a local parish as such. I was in Fresno, I was head of Catholic Charities, so I wasn't a parish priest or a pastor in one of these towns. Where the priests really felt it were in these farming towns, where you had a couple of masses in English at which the growers went, then a couple of masses in Spanish at which the farm workers went, and you had them in the same parish, in the same church, albeit different times. And I think that's where the tensions were very difficult. And basically, people didn't know what to do. But the role of the church from almost from day one was to not take sides, which the demand upon us was to take sides. And we did not. We said, no, that is not our role. But the workers do have rights, and the growers have certain rights. And our role really is to help protect and guarantee the rights of all parties, and the extent that we can to help mediate controversies, disputes, and to see how we can resolve this matter peacefully.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you about your thoughts and maybe a story, if you think of a good story, on a couple of different areas. The Delano Giomara situation, you were a mediator, and apparently you brought Caratan Pandolf to the table also. How did you go about doing that? Can you tell us that story?
Well, you've got to remember that what actually brought that whole thing to the finding to the table in negotiations was the table grape boycott of began 1968. So this was in 1972-73. The settlement actually in the announcement was in the summer or spring of 73. Actually, the boycott pressure is what then put the people together. That was not an easy thing to get all of these parties together. And I would say the most difficult aspect of this entire matter, if I may say so, were all the attorneys. To the extent that we could get attorneys out of the room in these negotiations, we made progress. When you could get the farm workers and the growers talking to each other, we made an enormous amount of progress. I remember one situation in that area where the grower, it was a large operation, and he was the only grower in negotiations with the union, and his attorneys were in San Francisco, so they weren't there for the negotiations. So all during these 2 days, this grower and that's a great story. So. Sure.
Okay, that's the end of camera roll 34. We're now going to camera 35. I take that back. I lied. It's not the end of camera roll 34. We're still on it.
Your Excellency, I think that you inadvertently gave the date for the negotiations as 73 instead of 70. Is that possible? I heard 73.
There were two different settlements.
Oh, I see. You were talking about the Coachella at 73.
No, there were actually three sets of negotiations in Delano. I should have mentioned
70. There, 70 was the big one. There were about 33, 34 growers involved in that one.
Yeah, I was wondering if you want to start with that.
As I get older and this gets farther away, you know, I don't always have the dates exactly correct.
So. We're talking about 1970 Delano.
Yeah. There were several, in a sense.
You were involved in a whole series of negotiations. Each big contract.
That's right.
Each time the growers agreed to negotiate, there would be like the committee come in.
And I think one thing you should ask is why were the bishops involved and not the state or somebody else? Because that's a very important factor. Why the Catholic bishops were involved and not the state or the Federal Mediation Service, who should have been involved. Because that's an extremely important point in the whole history of the farm worker movement.
Exactly. Okay, so well, after we get off the Delano, we'll go into that, and then I want to ask about the
team. I'll try to avoid dates to the extent I can, because especially in the 70s, so much was happening.
Right. We can write to that.
Yeah.
We can do
that. I'll just leave the dates out.
Yeah. Putting dates in. Yeah, you don't have to worry about the dates.
Okay, Marker?
You started to tell us the story about 1970 in Delano. Could you go over that story, please?
Well, there were so many interesting things that happened, but attorneys were not always helpful. We found that the extent that we could get growers and farm workers to sit down and talk to each other without attorneys, we made a lot of progress. And I remember one situation where it was a large grower by himself negotiating with Caesar and some of his people, and we were involved as mediators in that. And it happened to be that this attorney's the attorneys for this grower were in San Francisco. They weren't there in Bakersfield. So about 3:30 that day, the grower and the union reached an agreement. Well, about 4 o'clock, in come these attorneys. And so the grower said to his attorneys, well, he said, we've reached an agreement. All we need to do is get the paperwork signed, and we can sign this in the morning. And the attorney said, that is absolutely impossible. It'll take days, weeks maybe, to review this and get this ready. And I remember this grower put his arms around Caesar and he said, Mr. Chavez, he said, this is one of the problems we have in agriculture. He said, but we'll have this agreement all typed by tomorrow morning, or we'll have probably new attorneys. And I almost applauded because we had so much difficulty. They somehow were always an obstacle to getting something settled.
Why were the bishops?
Marker?
Why is it that the church was brought in, the bishops were brought in to mediate instead of the federal government, the state government? That's kind of unusual.
Well, it's one of the sad commentaries on agriculture and farm labor. Unfortunately, up to this day, agriculture is totally excluded from the National Labor Relations Act, enacted in 1935 to protect the rights of workers. And over the years, almost every group of workers in the country have been added to that protection, except agriculture. It is still excluded. The same with the state. And now the state does have now a California Agriculture Labor Relations Act, which is, I think, quite good. But neither the state mediation service nor the federal mediation service actually had any jurisdiction in this. We were able to coerce gently the state and the federal to do a couple of things, but they did it with great reluctance, and then they just would not participate. So there really was nobody there who was able to step forward and be acceptable to both sides and serve as mediator. So they asked the Bishop's Committee on Farm Labor, which I was secretary, if they would accept that role.
Did they be with the growers, the farm workers?
Both the farmers and the farm workers.
Okay. Now, in addition to mediating between the growers and the farm workers, there was another element that came in, the Teamsters. What were your recollections of those deals?
Well, that was a very sad chapter, actually several chapters in this. The Teamsters had a contract with one large lettuce grower in Salinas. And the growers then, in my opinion, went to the Teamsters, with whom they had a pretty good relationship, and tried to get the Teamsters to force out the farm workers. Because the growers, I think, felt they could deal with the Teamsters more to their advantage than they could this grassroots farm workers group. And the Teamsters said yes. And in fact, we were involved with the meeting with the Teamsters several times. It was very, very unpleasant. The Teamsters put a lot of pressure on, and I'd have to say, sadly, kind of lived up to the Teamsters' image of that period in history. We saw a lot of brutality and violence and things happening. I was really surprised. When I was with the Farm Labor Board, I was surrounded by a hostile group of Teamsters and had all the tires of my car slashed. It was a very difficult situation. So we tried to mediate this and work out a jurisdictional arrangement that the Teamsters would only be involved with certain commodities or certain geographical areas in that. And that never went very well. However, in the other side of it, the Teamsters did not have a lot of success in recruiting farm workers to join their union. So it eventually ended up in kind of a stalemate at first. The Teamsters got very few farm workers to join them and got very few contracts. Then it kind of died out, then came back again, a new effort, and the new effort was a little bit more successful for a while, but eventually the Teamsters finally just left.
Now, did you consider, or do you still consider, Caesar to be a religious or a spiritual person?
Well, I personally think that his own spirituality, his own religious faith, was the very core of who he was and where he really derived his strength and his energy. I never met a man of such faith as Caesar. Caesar would go to Mass every day that he could, was actively involved with his faith, always had Our Lady Guadalupe in the center of everything they were doing. Any march had to be led by Our Lady of Guadalupe, either a statue or a big banner. He would, whatever they did with the farm workers, always had to have Mass every day, whatever they did. His own spirituality was extremely powerful. I think it is also what helped him, assisted him in his fasts, which assisted him with the many reverses, the deaths of farm workers, the difficulties they encountered, all of the opposition. I was always impressed with that deep personal faith.
Now, his deep personal faith, how did that affect the union that he was forming, the group that he was leading?
Oh, well, it had an enormous effect because, first of all, it helped bring a calming influence to the membership, especially when there had been real adversity, and they had a lot of them. And he had a way of making sure that the movement stayed nonviolent, and that was his primary goal. In fact, he said many times, If our union becomes violent, then the whole thing is over. We quit. We're not having it. Because he would simply not allow violence to be a part of this effort. He felt that the integrity of the farm workers, what they were really striving for in their future, demanded this type of respect for each other, even the other side.
What were your feelings as a member of the church, as a human being, about Caesar's fasts? What were your thoughts on his fasts?
Well, of course, his fasts were, from our perspective, quite biblical. Fasts are very, very well known, certainly in the Old Testament, but as well as the New Testament. Jesus began his public ministry with a 40-day fast. Fasting was something very important in the whole Christian history, and it still is. And, of course, Caesar saw it from two perspectives, his own Christian perspective, as well as the nonviolence of Gandhi and the Indian perspective, in which Gandhi himself had many fasts for nonviolence. So Caesar really brought the two of them together, his Christian spiritual religiosity on one hand, as well as Gandhi's nonviolence influence on the other hand.
What do you believe is the greatest contribution of Caesar and the UFW to workers, to society?
Well, I think the greatest contribution Caesar has made is that farm workers' situation will never go back to what it was prior to the 1965. That to the extent that the growers may not like the union or like the organization of farm workers, the very presence of the union and its continuing presence and their continuing winning of elections, by the way, and contracts, continues to have a broad influence, not only in California, but other places as well, because the influence is almost one of intimidation. That is, other growers say, if we don't bring our wages and working conditions up to the level that the union has negotiated with other growers, then we're going to be subject to a unionization effort. So in a sense, even though Cesar's group has not organized all the farm workers in California or across the country, organizing even a small number well with good contracts sets a range and a standard, a minimum, below which people can't go. And so that influence has been very important.
You were involved with the Agricultural Labor Relations Board. Did you feel it was working in the past, or is it working now?
Well, the Agricultural Labor Relations Board was quite a daring venture by then young Jerry Brown, the governor, because within the first weeks, really, of his first term, he started this effort and really helped get the growers and the union together to pass a piece of legislation that all could agree to. And so it's a very, very important precedent. It's the only state legislation like it in the United States. It mirrors very closely the National Labor Relations Act, except for things that are peculiar to agriculture. For example, time frames. Elections, for example, under the ALRA, or California law, occur within 7 days. Well, under the National Labor Relations Act, they could be weeks or months before election, because they don't deal with the fast harvest turnover in that. But I think it's a very monumental piece of legislation. Is it working? I think it has worked, I would say, up and down. I think it worked fairly well when we began it. We held enormous numbers of elections, got into a lot of, certified a lot of elections, got into a lot of interesting cases, and precedents, many of them upheld by the courts, because there are no precedents for agriculture in the National Labor Relations Act, because they don't cover agriculture. So you can't find precedents. So we were the precedents, in a sense. It depends on who's the governor, and who are the members of the board, and who's the general counsel. And to that extent, you have either a proactive or less active board. And we have seen, I think, good boards and weaker boards. At this time, I would say we have more of a weaker board. You seldom hear from them. Now that the union is more active again and winning a lot of elections, I'm hoping that the board will become more responsive and more helpful.
Okay, let's just change. We just got a couple more questions.
Sure, no problem.
Yes, Pete.
Rolling.
Marker.
What were your thoughts when you heard that Cesar Chavez had passed?
Well, of course, immediate sense of sadness at the loss of such a charismatic leader. And the real question came to my mind is, is there somebody else who can step forward now and carry on the same vision, offer the same dynamic and energy that Cesar had brought to this movement? I think it was a concern for, immediate concern for his family, obviously, and their loss, but also a real concern about the union and the future of farm workers. And that was a great concern. But the more I thought about it and prayed about it, I felt, well, you know, that in the Lord's providence, this is going to work out okay. Somehow, the Lord gave us Cesar for this number of years, and somehow in that providence, there will be a future and a continuation that will be bright. And I became more at peace with it, and even more so than at the funeral itself. And then I was really convinced, seeing the outpouring of love and concern and support and the commitment of people at the funeral, I said, no, the vision has been struck in stone, and it is not going to fade.
You have a couple of good stories. Can you tell us the story of the disappearing ballot boxes?
Well, it was interesting. One of the tasks of the Bishops Committee at times was to conduct elections when the growers a grower at a ranch and the union requested it. Again, because the Federal Mediation Service and State Mediation Service wouldn't do it. So one time we had an election on a ranch, and because it was an enormously large ranch, there were several voting sites around the ranch. So because it was easier to have four or five voting places and let workers come to those rather than try to bus all of the workers into one place. Well, what happened was that these ballot boxes weren't terribly secure. I mean, they were kind of homemade. And, I mean, one could easily take the top off if you wanted to. Well, nobody had arranged for how these ballot boxes were to be protected and secured and got back to one place so you could count the ballots. So, and I was at one place, I guess at the headquarters location, and at the end of the balloting, I said, well, now how are the other ballot boxes going to get here under security and all that? Well, and the grower said, oh, he said, I've taken care of it. Don't worry about it. So after about a half hour, here comes this pickup truck, and here's one of his foremen by himself in the pickup truck. In the front cab are these four ballot boxes. And he had been gone, he had picked them up and had been gone for about 45 minutes with these boxes, and then shows up at the place where we're going to count the ballots. And I said, wait, time out. I said, where have you been for 45 minutes by yourself with these ballot boxes? And he hemmed and hawed and all, and I said, you didn't look in any of these boxes by any chance, and he hemmed and hawed. So I said, election's over, forget the ballots. But, just somehow they thought that they could get away with that kind of thing, that the foreman could take the ballot boxes, and I guess he went to the ranch equipment shed and maybe counted them or changed them or did something with them, but then showed up with these boxes. You know.
Was that an unusual situation, or were there other stories that happened at other times?
Well, that had happened several times, actually. We learned quick, though, that we tried from there on to always have only one ballot location where you could have monitors from both sides and members of our committee could be at one location so that all of the balloting was done under supervision. We wouldn't allow, except for a rare case, that kind of other situation. What we actually did in those situations in the future was we had like 2 to 3 hour balloting times. We would all go to location A for 3 hours, then location B for 3 hours. But we moved ourselves and the monitors with the ballot boxes together. So
that's the only way.
There were some interesting situations.
You had another story about the cantaloupe.
Well, yes, there was a big cantaloupe strike going on both in Coachella and out in the West Side Fireball Mendota area. And Caesar and the union were negotiating with one of the biggest growers, cantaloupe growers in the world at the time. But it was a very messy strike, and it was not pleasant. There was a lot of violence, and there were a lot of things going on. Well, here we are down at an airport hotel, Los Angeles International Airport, carrying on these negotiations. And in the afternoon, there was a break. And the break was over. And I would say there were maybe 8 or 10 farm workers and 8 or 10 members of this growers on the other side. So as we sit down at the table, in come these waiters with these trays. On the trays are halves of cantaloupes with a scoop of ice cream in them as kind of a refreshment. Well, I never saw Caesar get so upset in my whole life. Jumped right off the chair when he saw these cantaloupes arrive. Here they're suffering this terrible, terrible disaster in the strike and all kinds of violence, and the workers are getting bashed around. And here, this grower orders cantaloupes to be served at the end of the break. And I never saw Caesar, I don't think, so angry in all the years I knew him. One of the great gifts of Caesar could not swear. Caesar did not know how to swear. He never used any bad words, so he didn't. So when he ever tried, it was funny because it never worked. And he tried to kind of swear at these fellas, and but their insensitivity to not realize that with this terrible tension and that, the last thing in the world you bring into the room are cantaloupes. And I think he just pointed out the big gap in even awareness of the two sides. The growers, their lack of understanding that this was even an issue. you know, that to be aware of the feelings and the sensitivities and that, it just simply was part of the big gap. Anyway, we got rid of the cantaloupes and took another break and got Cokes and everybody kind of settled down again.
Okay, this is sound roll number 16, and we're continuing on camera roll 36. Take 5 is next.
He gets out to the coast from time to time. He's on that Robert Kennedy Farm Workers Health Board. I think he's still on it.
Sound roll, or this is take 5.
Yeah. If you write to him, I have his address. If you write to him and inquire if he's going to be out here, that'd be well worth your while if you have a chance.
Okay. Now, apparently, you and Monsignor Higgins were the two members of the church who were quite involved. How did that work?
Well, they established this committee of five bishops and then asked Monsignor George Higgins to be the consultant to the committee and myself to be the secretary. Monsignor Higgins was based in Washington, D.C. As it turned out, he and I were always, almost always there for everything. Most of the time, many of the bishops could not be present. So it turned out that we were probably the mainstays of the presence of the bishops' committee throughout all of these years. He was tremendous to work with because he had such an intense background in labor, very involved with the labor movement, new unions inside and out in negotiations, and that he was extraordinarily valuable. He was very incisive. During negotiations, he had a way of kind of summarizing out loud where he thought the parties were at this moment. He was able to identify the outstanding issues, to help them prioritize those, of which ones they could deal with quickly, which ones were the stumbling block. He just brought a unique background and gifts to the process. And I just enjoyed him so much. He was unique in his experience and expertise. And I don't think, without Monsignor Higgins, I don't think much of the success would have occurred.
Any anecdote that stands out in your mind about Monsignor Higgins and that would really exemplify how it is he worked?
Well, I don't remember which negotiation it was, but I remember at one point it was obvious that the negotiations were not going anywhere, and there was pretty much a stalemate. And he would just kind of get up and say, "Well," he'd say, "Gentlemen, let me tell you the reality is that." Growers, your position on Friday is the same as it was Monday, and the unions is the same as it was Tuesday. And unless we can do something about that, we might as well all go home. And he had a way of saying it that didn't make people angry, but kind of motivated them. And he said, I got things to do in Washington, and if you don't want to negotiate, why don't you just say so, and I can go home. And he had a way of saying it that sparked a positive response. Or he would say, it's 3:00 Friday afternoon, I'm leaving tomorrow afternoon, so if you want to get serious about this, let's do it. If not, let's just get out of here. And sure enough, things would start happening again. And then pretty soon, by 3:00 Saturday, maybe the whole thing had been settled. He had a way of knowing when to say something and when not to say something, what to say and how to say it, that accomplished a great deal.
And one person that's
hurt myself.
This one more back.
Okay, one change.
This change right here? Yeah. Got Helen Huerta and yes. Thank
you.
Okay. That's the end of camera roll 36. Going to 37. Our next take will be take 6.
Yeah, I don't tell that Dolores story because I've told it to her several times and she kind of cringes. She says, I hope you're not telling people that story. And I said, only close friends, but I said, I've never told the media that story.
Then you can keep your promise.
Yeah, but it is great. I mean, it's typical Dolores. You know, she is such a different temperament than Caesar.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's you.
Yes, Robin. Robin?
Take six.
Take six.
You were saying that you did have some differences of opinion as to priorities with Caesar. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. At times, I wondered about the priority and effectiveness of the boycotts, because it seemed to me that too much time and effort and resources were being placed on the boycotts, and I always wondered how much value they were getting in return. Now, I understand that the 1968 table grape boycott was quite effective, and therefore resulted in 1970 signings. But then the dynamics in society began to change, too. And I think the boycott in the last several years, from my perspective, was quite ineffective. And besides, it was very confusing, because here, all through the winter months, you had all these table grapes from Chile, which were, in effect, not being boycotted. Yet the labor conditions down there are far worse than they are up here. And when we get to the spring and summer, we have USA grapes being boycotted. So the whole thing, I thought, was the wrong focus.
Did you tell Caesar?
Yes, I told Caesar. And I'd have to say, early on, he thought that I was wrong, and that the power of the boycott, if done well, was going to win. And I said, but we don't have the same late 1960s, early 70s groups and mentality in this country that we did then. And I said, therefore, you're dealing with a different America in that sense. And so people aren't responding to things like that in the same way. And but I noticed later on, I think he became a little bit more open to that. And I think they began to emphasize more and more the organizational efforts. And in fact, I encouraged him to do so. And in fact, he was doing more of that. The union today is doing a lot more of that, and I think with great success. Now, they still have the boycott going, but they're not spending so much time and effort in their main people. They're out organizing farm workers, which is their great gift.
Now, one of the people that's important to the movement, what was in the background, is Helen. Helen Chavez. What are your recollections of Helen?
Well, you got to remember, here you have Cesar Chavez, who himself is a very humble, self-effacing person, and his wife's even more so. So it was very, very difficult to ever get Helen into the forefront. She felt that her role was not to be a spokesperson, not to be active, not to be out in front, but to be supportive of Caesar and everybody else. And she was wonderful. Of course, they had young children at the time, too. In 1965, their children were in grammar school and going into high school. So she had quite a bit of responsibility with the family. So it wasn't easy for her to just pick up and leave. But she also had the same kind of deep faith that Caesar had. She also had a way of inspiring people, too, by just her faith and her simplicity. She wouldn't have to say much to gain an enormous amount of respect and following, really, of people. Because she was so genuine, and her goodness and all, it was so obvious. There was nothing artificial about Helen, just a very fine, strong, good woman. And she still is, and again, is the mainstay, I think, of the union.
You have apparently a good story behind one of the leading growers, pretty tough guy, Jack Pendle.
Well, Jack Pendle is a very, very smart grower, but also very volatile. Jack he loved it. Every time I saw a television camera or a reporter ran over, Jack Pendle was quoted in every story because Jack Pendle started talking to everybody. Well, one time there was an election taking place in the Delano area at a ranch. And as the election was going on, there was also outside on the road a banner of Our Lady Guadalupe. And I think what had happened was a lot of the farm workers who had voted had gone outside and were having some kind of a little prayer service around Our Lady Guadalupe. From what I could tell from the building where I was in looking out, that's what was happening. Well, all of a sudden I hear all this yelling and screaming outside, and I thought somebody was being killed. It was awful, and all this racket. And so I went outside, and here's Jack Pannell outside screaming and yelling, looking for me, because he said, those farm workers over there on the road, they're having mass. And if they're having mass, that's influencing the election, and they shouldn't be doing this, and get them out of here, et cetera, et cetera. So I just laughed, and I said, Jack, if you'd been to mass recently yourself, you would know they're not over there having mass. They're just saying a couple of prayers. So he even laughed at that. He thought that was pretty funny. But we had some interesting times with people, individuals like that.
Jack Pendle also, as you said, is someone who loved the camera. What is it with him? I've interviewed him before. What's so special about Jack Pendle? What in his background makes him?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but he's very self-assured, you know, and he thinks he's absolutely right about everything. He's very smart, and he's been very successful. And it's so ironic, and I always used to tell him this. I said, this is so ironic. Here you are up here battling these poor farm workers, and yet you've got huge operations in Mexico where you're working hand in glove with all these Mexicans. And I said, it's so ironic. I mean, most people don't know about all of those Mexico operations. And I said, he's working really this whole thing from both angles. But he had a way of, I would say, explosive journalism, that he would just yell and scream and get someone's attention. Pretty soon he was on the camera, and he talked so loud that he thought the louder he got, the more right he was, as if the volume indicated the truthfulness of what he said. And it was a riot. I just joked with him. I never took him seriously, but he's very, very smart, and he was very effective.
Thank you. Jack Pamelo, I interviewed him a number of years ago, and we walk into his operation. It's
Hollis Wade, 350 pounds. Did you ever know him personally?
Oh,
or say?
No, I just read about him. He sounded pretty colorful.
Oh, he was a riot. He had he had this office, I would say his personal office, and I'm not exaggerating, was at least four times the size of this room. And his wife decorated it. It was the most god-awful thing you'd ever seen. It looked like, you know, you use the expression, Fort Worth, Texas whorehouse inside. It was the most gaudy velvet on the walls. It was awful. Anyway, Hollis, and he was so big that he had this enormous desk with a big half moon cut out so he could get up to it. Well, at the signing, he had peaches, huge peaches. And here they are out in front, and it was a Los Angeles Times reporter said, Hollis has his arm around Caesar. Caesar is disappeared in the folds of Hollis Roberts. And this reporter from LA Times says, he says, Mr. Roberts, he said, you know, I've been following you for a number of years. You've been one of the...
No, we're fine.
One of the...
Oh,
we'll get it. He said, you've been one of the most outspoken opponents of Cesar Chavez over the years. You have called him the most vile names, and on and on. And he says, he's got all these quotes. And he said, and here today, you got a big cigar in your mouth, you got your arms around Cesar, you've just signed a contract. What happened? And Hollis says, well, he said, I've come to learn over these weeks and months what an outstanding man this Cesar Chavez was. I didn't know all about his personal qualities, etc. I didn't know about his efforts and careers. I didn't know all these things. And there's a long pause, and he says, and besides, I couldn't get my damn peaches picked. Well, everybody just howled, you know, because that was obviously what got the contract. I couldn't get my damn peaches picked.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Best wishes.
That was a great story. The last story told was a great
okay,
story.
And room tone. And that's the end of the interview with Cardinal Mahoney.
Hollis Roberts.
We do have that last story on tape.
Oh, good.
On tape.
It's noisy. I mean, the air conditioning's on. And
yeah,
well, the camera department's
usable,
making noise.
That's
the
kind of went through my mind.
It was on my mind because when I was reviewing the Levy book, there's the exact story verbatim told by Kircher.
Oh, really?
Kircher or Higgins tells that story about
well,
the candle. So,
the panel,
I mean, no, tells the Hollis story.
Well, let's get Higgins.
So
to
maybe
do it.
Higgins will do it.
Okay.
It's a very funny story. It's the same thing. He went to their house and he had his feet up on the furniture. Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So, David, everything that we're putting
we'll
here,
in
now we have to take it down, man.
That's true.
So maybe you can take care of the cables.
Right. So, and do everything.
Yeah, unplug them. Yeah, I'm plugging it from the wall.
Okay. That's the end of the sound roll, the end of shooting for today. Goodbye.